KZSU FM Stanford, welcome to another edition of Hearsay Culture. My name is Dave Levine. I'm an assistant professor of law at Elon University School of Law in Greensboro, North Carolina, as well as a fellow at the Center for Internet and Society at Stanford Law School. Thank you for joining me today on the show. Today I'm excited to have on Fred Stutzman, a doctoral candidate at the University of North Carolina Chapel Hill School of Information and Library Science. Fred is doing very interesting work on social media, and particularly, we're going to focus on two of his areas of exploration. The first are a couple of applications that he's written for PCs and for Apples that are designed to basically force computer users to avoid not only social media, but the internet, depending on which app you choose. And we're going to talk about those applications and their success and their impetus and some of the theoretical underpinnings, as well as the practical implications of the existence of those apps. And we're also going to spend time talking about Fred's doctoral dissertation, something that he is working on now and is close to completion. His dissertation focuses again on social media, but more specifically, he's looking at how social media is used during periods of life transition. And the focus of his dissertation is the transition that young adults make from high school to college. And so we're going to talk about that study and some of the conclusions that he's reaching or perhaps has reached, given that he's finishing the dissertation, and ultimately have a broad-ranging discussion about social media and its impact. Again, Fred is a doctoral candidate at UNC Chapel Hill. He has a BA in economics and a graduate certificate in quantitative methodologies from the Odom Institute for Research in Social Sciences at the University of North Carolina. In 2011, he'll be joining Carnegie Mellon University as a postdoctoral fellow. And I should also note that aside from having read about the Freedom application, the one that shuts down the internet in the press, Fred had actually been recommended to me as a guest on the show from one of our previous guests, Paul Jones at the University of North Carolina, and Fred and Paul work together there. So I'm very excited to have Fred on the show. I think this will be a good conversation, and let's start things off. So Fred is joining us by Skype from Chapel Hill. Fred, thank you for joining us today.
Oh, thank you.
Let's start off with the standard question I ask most of my guests. Talk a bit more about your background and how you became interested in your field, focusing on social media and sociology.
Mm-hmm. Well, I've always been interested in the interaction of technology and our social lives, basically. What is it about technology that makes and allows people to come together? My earliest experience with this was getting a computer. My father brought home a computer and watching movies like War Games and getting interested in doing things like dialing into bulletin boards and joining messaging services and things like that. So at a very early age, I was sort of exposed to some of the interesting sort of connective aspects of the internet. And it was sort of before we called it the internet, of course, because it was dial-in. I became very interested in that and sort of followed a trajectory where I sort of continued to participate with others in online communities and basically saw the impacts of that. And so this really became very evident to me when I went to college. I moved from New York to North Carolina to attend my undergrad, and I didn't know anybody. So I found that I was sort of using online communities, things like Instant Messenger and email and things like that, to have sort of a very real social experience with my friend that I'd left behind. It was very kind of a supportive thing, and I just sort of got fascinated in how we actually find support through these technologies, how they help us live our lives. And so I've just been sort of chasing that. I've been chasing that idea for going on 20 years now, I suppose. And it's it just still tickles me to this day that I get to study it at the graduate and postgraduate level.
Are you, and I feel the same way about the work that I do, that, you know, and I hope my dean is listening to this, but I feel like, you know, there's a lot of stuff that I would do for a lot less money, because I enjoy it so much. But again, you know, if my dean's listening, I appreciate the salary, and I'd like it to keep coming, and certainly my children and appreciate it. But let me ask you this. Were you an early adopter of, it sounds like you may have been, of social media? And by that I mean Facebook, which is the current iteration of it, but perhaps your involvement with social media goes back a bit further than that. So perhaps you could talk more specifically about that.
Yes, it does. You know, it's kind of fuzzy, you know, what exactly is social media? Where do we draw the boundaries? But thinking about sort of the first social networking sites, well, a lot of people credit 6degrees.com as being the first social network site. I'm not so much an early adopter that I was on there, but I did participate in and was fascinated by the early iterations of Friendster. And of course, following Friendster was MySpace. At sort of the time in my life where those sites were becoming popular, they were very, very useful to me. I was moving between jobs. I had just left college, and I was absolutely fascinated with this idea that you could sort of have a virtual social network. And so, yeah, I adopted those sites. I became a very heavy user. And it was when I read an article, I think it was in the New York Times Year in Ideas, they interviewed Duncan Watts about the science of networks and the study of networks and what we can learn from networks. And I realized that, wow, we can actually study this. So, you know, I've been chasing social media for a long time, but it was when I actually saw the power in the data, the power in being able to study these connections and interactions at such large scale that I said, well, I can actually pursue this.
So, you know, when I think about my own experience with social media, and this helps us contextualize the discussion we're going to have, you know, I and it sounds like we're of similar vintage. You know, when I was in college, the bulletin boards were starting to take off, and I vividly recall, and this is now the early 90s, getting on Prodigy and using bulletin boards to just communicate with people. And this was really a primitive form of email, because ultimately one person would post something to a board and then people would respond to it, and it would go from there. You know, in terms of where and how and really how we define social media today, those appear to be our antecedents. Is that the kind of social media that you think is relevant to our discussion today, or have we moved beyond Prodigy when we think about what we can do with Facebook that we couldn't do otherwise? How do you trace that history?
It's sort of interesting, actually. You know, putting a boundary on social media is difficult. I mean, Facebook is clearly one way in which we can sort of operationalize social media. You've got pictures, you list your interests, you connect with people. Twitter, you know, is another example. Twitter is a site where you're broadcasting short status messages. And interestingly enough, Twitter, kind of the idea of socializing around little bits of text, little bits of, you know, very economical shared text, goes back way before Prodigy and way before telephones and back to the days of the telegraph. There's a very interesting book by Tom Standage called The Victorian Internet, and in it he traces the lineage of basically the pre-internet internet. That was telegraph and telegraph operators. So we've been finding ways to connect around little bits of meaningful social content for hundreds of years. It's in our nature, and the form obviously keeps changing. But the thing that I sort of keep coming back to is, what's interesting about it? What drives us? What motivates us to connect? And it's interesting. Photos are certainly one great thing, and Facebook is absolutely wonderful at affording that. But also in the context of Twitter, coming together around sort of shared bits of text and shared bits of culture that are created through little bits of information, you know, it's another way. And so I see all of these kind of falling under a sort of larger bubble of social interactions. And I'm interested about, you know, what could come next, because, you know, the more we sort of boil down to the essence, you know, I think the more meaningful the interactions become.
And that brings us to, I think, a very broad question I'm going to ask, but I think it helps set the stage. You know, social media is getting a lot of attention now, not only because Facebook is so popular and Twitter also, but also because of the movie the Social Network, which I won't ask you to do an impromptu movie review, but certainly it has, I think, caused more people to think about what these websites look like. But a lot of these issues do tend to be boiled down to these rather simplified questions of whether something is good or isn't good, and that seems to be a debate that has, you know, always lingered, but certainly has become more prevalent today when people talk about whether the internet is a good thing or not. And I guess to contextualize the discussion, I'm going to ask you this rather pedantic question, but do you have a normative position on the internet and its net benefits to society? I mean, clearly you've used social media in ways that were positive for you. Do you think that translates to others? And obviously that's part of your study, but do you have a holistic view of the internet at this point?
Well, I look at the internet much like I look at other technologies. I see it sort of as an infrastructure. And where I see social media getting interesting is the fact I think of it as an infrastructure of participation. It's basically systems that are built to allow us to collaborate and to communicate and to be together. And so the uses of these technologies are entirely contextual. They can be used for good or for bad. People can organize a birthday party, or people can organize, a riot. There's not one applied or accepted use of these tools. That's of course what makes them so interesting and allows them to sort of powerfully integrate with society. But you know, that said, there are some interesting affordances of these technologies that I think do benefit certain populations. Thinking about using the internet as a communication device for people who have more sparse social networks, who don't have people to call on in person, so to speak, they may actually get a benefit as a result of having people that they can communicate with virtually. And of course, there's nothing entirely new about that with social media. People could do that with email. But social media is interesting in the sense that it's really more about the everyday, and it's got sort of communication systems that are built and driven towards this idea that you monitor and keep in frequent contact with people you care about. So that's interesting. Is it a net good or net bad? It's all about the uses, and that's my sort of hedging answer that I always give to questions like this.
I think it's a legitimate answer, clearly. But I will push a little bit further on it, just a little bit, and just throw this out to you. So you know, certainly, you know, people like Larry Lessig and Jamie Boyle and Yochai Benkler and people with whom you're familiar have argued more or less that there are values built into the infrastructure. So that for example, the current debate involving net neutrality boils down to whether we're going to change the pipes. I mean, to put it in a very simplified form. Do you reject that concept? In other words, do you view the internet as purely a system of tubes, or do you think that there are values inherent in the infrastructure by virtue of the people that built it and what their values were? Or have we moved so far from that ideal that it's no longer an apt comparison or thing to think about?
Oh, no. No, as somebody who's built software and who studies software, I see values in everything that I interact with. There's no question about it. There's a certain economy that designers and our infrastructure builders have to follow that does prize and put some values ahead of others. So no, there's the internet is not a value-neutral technology, and infrastructure is also not value-neutral, even though infrastructure, sort of in its bare sense, seems like it could be value-neutral. But, you know, thinking about questions of access, I think are actually one of the greatest ways in which we can see some of the ways in which values are realized in technology. And so, you know, these questions of things like governing access to net neutrality, I see these as very much competition between a technology that's striving to somehow break the boundaries of, or somehow break its ties to maybe the systems of values that it was created with, but then we've got sort of normative factors that are attempting to bring the technologies back into line with current values. And I think, you know, thinking about preferential treatment of content, thinking about filtering of content that's not sort of certified by third parties, it's very much the imposition of values onto something that is striving to, you know, not necessarily be value neutral, but to be more open and available. And certainly, you know, thinking about social networks, I mean, values are inherent in social networks. There are things you can't say. There are things you can't do on Facebook. You cannot upload a picture of a woman breastfeeding to Facebook. Certain forms of hate speech are banned, you know, which is probably a good thing. But the values are everywhere. And I think also, you know, in the privacy systems, that's probably where I see them, you know, affect us most. Facebook, I think, is a, you know, as we've talked, they've been talked about extensively in terms of the privacy aspects. You know, Facebook's privacy systems are geared towards individuals that basically are able to be open. And being able to be open, being able to share your life, is something that's not available to all of us. It's entirely a sort of a decision that's trapped up in values. So, you know, I think actually using critical approaches towards the technologies and the infrastructures allows us to identify some of these values and potentially find ways to deal with some of the negative implications of it.
We're chatting with Fred Stutzman of UNC Chapel Hill on KZSU-FM Stanford and Hearsay Culture. Fred, you know, as you know, this show airs on KZSU. KZSU broadcasts from Stanford University, and its signal is plenty strong enough to go about 2 miles south of campus down to where Facebook is headquartered. And so I mentioned that to you because as this show airs in the Bay Area, it is beamed directly into Facebook's offices, and Facebook doesn't have the ability, as far as I know, to use the Freedom or Antisocial app to block the signal. you have developed these applications, which I'll allow you to explain. So what is Freedom and Antisocial? I know that you've developed a few others, but let's focus on those two. What do they purport to do?
Well, what they purport to do is they essentially take you offline in differing degrees of severity. Freedom is a internet blocker. Basically, what you do is you turn on the program, or well, you install it first, then you turn it on, tell it how long you'd like to be offline, and it locks you offline for that period of time. To get back online, you actually have to reboot your computer. Simply turning off the program is not good enough. And so for people who are writers and researchers and who have to work on long-form tasks, who are distracted by the internet and email and all the sort of social things that go on, it's a great way to get work done. And that's really what it's built for. I built it because, you know, as somebody who studies social media, I could legitimize being on Facebook. I could just tell myself it's research. But to actually complete my work, I had to really buckle down and deal with these distractions. So I built it, you know, first and foremost for myself, and I think other people found it useful. Now, a lot of people who've used this software have told me that being offline is great, but they actually need to get access to resources. They need to be able to research things and, you know, get to databases and so on and so forth. And so thinking about the real problem for a lot of people, I realized that it was the sort of hum of the social internet that is distracting. It is the concept that you've got people out there who are creating interesting content, responding to you, waiting for responses from you, that drives people to use these sites and to spend so much time on them. And so I created the second piece of software, Antisocial, which essentially just blocks the social parts of the internet. I think I say something along the lines of it turns your friends off, it really is. It's just a blocker of sites like Facebook and Twitter and MySpace. People turn it on and they can't be distracted by those sites. They can get their work done and sort of use the less social parts of the internet. It's the same deal. You turn it on, and you can't circumvent it without rebooting your computer, which people sort of hate to do. So it's an interesting psychological mechanism to increase productivity.
And it's funny because I recall reading an article, and this is probably now 3 or 4 years ago, even where someone who I for life of me, I cannot remember now, but someone who blogged a lot posted that he or she was going to be moving into an apartment for a few months where there was no internet access because this app didn't exist. And literally this person wanted to go into a place where the internet was impossible to access, and in fact did it, and then reemerged saying how productive he or she was. And I'm sure I'll remember the name of this person as soon as the show's over. It gets to an interesting comparable, I think, as you were talking about it. To mix metaphors, your computer, your PC, your Apple and so forth, are dual-use technologies. As you mentioned, there are uses that add to your productivity and might detract from it, unless, as you mentioned, you're someone researching social media, and then you get the best of all worlds, I suppose. but that differs from something perhaps like a BlackBerry, where BlackBerry is marketed itself primarily as a means to access email, and the impact of BlackBerries on people's lives, of course, has created the pseudonym CrackBerry to describe it, that people are addicted to it, and they're expected to be available 24/7 and so forth. Is your app designed to be the functional equivalent of taking your BlackBerry and throwing it in the ocean?
Well, I think that is a comparison there. I mean, when you throw the BlackBerry in the ocean, what you're doing is you're essentially cutting off your chain, your lifeline to the internet, your work, your obligations to others. If you don't have your BlackBerry and you can't get those emails telling you you need to work on that report at 6 o'clock on a Friday, then that stuff doesn't exist for you. And I think that freedom is along those lines. Basically, it's allowing people to prioritize their time in the sense that some time can be allocated to work and other times can be allocated to being online and being social. And I think people enjoy being proactive about that. I think that's something that's useful to them. We've sort of shifted into BlackBerry mode in terms of all of our production when you think about it. We're expected to keep email open all the time. We're expected to be able to respond at a moment's notice, and really, that's just horrible for productivity. Productivity works best when we're focused on sort of single tasks and are able to get into flows where we're working on that task. And so, this whole sort of BlackBerry culture that pervades modern computing is entirely bad and inherently troublesome for productivity. I see a very strong comparison. I also see, one of my points is, I as a designer of technologies and somebody who, coming back to the value issues, as somebody who very strongly sees values in technology, I see modern computing to a certain extent as failing us because we are distracted by our computers. If we think about what we used for work 5, 10, 15, 20, 30 years ago, you know, our devices were much simpler. They were focused on single tasks. You know, we used typewriters, we used, you know, word processors and early PCs that didn't have sort of the rich complexities that our modern computers have. YouTube, Hulu, social networks, all of these things that compete for our attention. And, you know, so sort of getting back to the values point, I look at a computer not as this actor that you know, basically has agency to take over our lives, but it's a machine that should work for us. And freedom is a very simple and really brute force way that an individual can exert power over the computer. They can basically, with the click of a button, turn off all of those things, all of those, you know, things that are sort of the part of the modern computer, the multimedia streaming, the social networks, the chat, the email, that distract us, and basically turn their computer back into a dumb old typewriter. And it just so happens that for a lot of people, a dumb old typewriter is what they need when it's time to get that draft done, or, you know, so on and so forth. So it's really actually, you know, it's a little bit of society failing us and a little bit of humans failing themselves, and that, you know, we have a hard time pulling ourselves away from these technologies. But I really see it as a failure of computers and the devices that we, you know, are supposed to use for work.
We're chatting with Fred Stutzman of UNC Chapel Hill on KZSU-FM, Stanford, and Hearsay Culture. For those of you that listen to the show regularly, you know that KZSU is a nonprofit, non-commercial radio station at Stanford University that relies on donations from listeners like you to continue its diverse programming. There are a couple of ways you could make a donation to KZSU. You could email our underwriting department at underwriting@kzsu.stanford.edu. Again, that's underwriting@kzsu.stanford.edu, or you can go to our webpage and click on Donate to KZSU, and the webpage address is kzsu.stanford.edu. Regardless, I do hope you continue to listen to the station as well as Hearsay Culture. You know, Fred, you got to a point there before the break that I think I want to pick up on, which is ultimately an issue of, as you mentioned, kind of human failing. What does the need for this brute force application that you've designed say about humans' ability to deal with the technology? You know, there is, as you know, more and more research being done on how technology, or the internet in particular, impacts the human brain, and how, for example, teenagers may not have the physiological development to make proper decisions and control themselves in social media. And we've got all this burgeoning research, and of course, you know, our understanding of the human brain certainly is improving, but it's still largely a mystery. What is the existence of this app say to you? Is the need for it to you a warning in any way about technology, or perhaps a warning that we need to question how we use it?
Mm-hmm. Well, I think it can be perceived as a warning, actually. I think that we only need to look at ourselves and look at the problems that we sort of face in our everyday computing, and realize that sort of the value sets that have been built into our computers, this idea that a computer should be about facilitating constant connection and multimedia and all of those things sort of mixed together with spreadsheets and word processing and computer programming and things like that, it's actually quite challenging. It's very challenging in the sense that we're trying to, you know, have productivity in one mode, and we're constantly challenged by these other distractions. And so so this sort of gets to a point about, you know, are we failing in the fact that we are distracted? And I think that's absolutely not the case. I mean, social media is popular because, and only because, we're social beings. You know, we as humans fundamentally are driven by the desire to connect with to connect with others and to partake in social groups and be aware of that. There's not too many social facts that I buy, but that's one of them. And so the fact that our computers are now this sort of channel where we can sort of act on our addictions to other people, and really that's what it is. It's not about the media. It's about other people. I see that as very much a warning. And I think it can be interpreted a couple of ways. You know, one is like, well, maybe we just need separate machines. We need a machine where we connect with people. And maybe, you know, in a couple of years, that will just be a souped-up mobile device that we all carry around. And it's really not a problem because we have these computer things that we do work on and we connect with individuals on our social mobile devices. But maybe it actually sends a shout to computer designers that they need to think about ways in which we can segment off parts of the computer. We can segment off the social from the work. It requires some thinking that I think the computer industry hasn't caught up with the industry, and I think they're a little bit uncomfortable about it because that would involve computers sort of taking a step backward, and that's not the ideology of the computing industry, and at least not for the last 50 years. So I do think we're going to need to think very creatively about the ways to address these issues of productivity, and I think antisocial and freedom are obviously interesting and surprising. Of course, I had no idea they would be successful or interesting to people when I designed them. Surprising exemplars of ways we might tackle the problem.
And to point this out, you do sell the applications. Yes. How successful have if you're willing to discuss it? How successful have they been? You mentioned it, you're surprised at the interest. Do you mind saying how they've done?
Well, so I do sell a registered copy. I actually gave Freedom away for a number of years, and I think through that period, I sort of estimated about 40 or 50,000 people downloaded it. I can't really say how many people use it. I don't have numbers on that. And in the past couple of years, there's probably about 5,000 people downloading it a month. Now, of course, not all of those people register it. A very, very small portion of people register it. So I am word. But I am, I am trying to make a business out of it because I think more than sort of the interesting gimmick of these applications, I think I've stumbled onto something with regards to how we deal with these very complex problems in human practice or, in our relationship with technology. And, just to sort of give a little bit of background, like I've said, the sort of dominant ideology of the computing industry, and when they want to solve a problem, is they design a solution and they keep adding features until they think they've either got the problem solved or it just becomes so complicated that nobody can use the technology. And, I say this coming from the human computer interaction community, so I say it lovingly, of course. And there are obviously many examples where people do simplicity well, of course. John made his work, the Laws of Simplicity. There's a lot of people who've thought of this, and I'm not original in any sense.
Well, the Quakers also have something to say about it too.
So, yeah, exactly. Yeah. Exactly. So there's a lineage of these ideas, but I think when we sort of reverse this dominant ideology of the computing industry being able to sort of fully solve a problem, and instead using solutions that get us most of the way there, part of the way there, in terms of something like Freedom, which it actually, if you were to sort of give it to a computer engineer, they'd say, well, you can reboot your computer and get back online. So obviously this is not a good solution. Well, actually, it just so happens that people don't want to reboot the computer. So there's psychological aspects. And so I want to keep understanding and building creative solutions for people that involve both the technology, these simple technologies and the psychological aspects that create sort of solutions that fit our practice. And that's really what it's about, fitting the technology to individuals' work practice.
We're chatting with Fred Stutzman of UNC Chapel Hill on KJSU FM Stanford and Hearsay Culture. Last question on these apps, Fred, before we turn to towards the work on your dissertation. Having read some of the reviews of the applications, one point that some seem to be making is that these applications in some way answer or perhaps confirm the concerns of the group of people that are internet skeptics or critics, that the internet's dumbing us down, that the internet is making us less productive, actually, and so forth. What do you say about that? I mean, is that do you think a fair conclusion deduction to take from not only the existence of the applications, but the fact that they've had some success?
Well, no, I don't. I don't believe that the internet is dumbing us down. I think, you know, if anything, the internet is connecting us, making us, you know. And actually, I should step back. I don't think the internet makes us anything. It's the resources on the internet and the connections that we make on the internet, and it affects our lives in a multitude of ways. And people have been studying and theorizing these sort of negative implications for, you know, as long as these technologies have been around. And sort of interestingly, you know, I taught a course here at the school that looked at historical perspectives on communication technologies, and people have been saying the same things about the internet, social networks, that they said about the cell phone, that they said about the telephone, that they said about the telegraph. These critiques in terms of they're going to make us less smart, they're going to disconnect us from society, they're going to, you know, these critiques have been levied against technologies forever. That said, I do think that there's something different about the sort of potential of these technologies to distract us, and that's kind of a confluence of a couple of issues. One being, technologies have evolved. You know, they're more rich, they're more interactive, they're instantaneous. Second point is that infrastructure has evolved. 15 years ago, we couldn't be distracted on our mobile devices because our mobile devices, there wasn't such thing as 3G or, you know, edge networks or things like that. And that's probably not true. I'm sure that stuff was around in prototype back then, but, you know, just for mass adoption. So it's really kind of a confluence of issues that I think does contribute to us being forced to deal with these new challenges to productivity, and, you know, just simply keeping us from sort of staying online all the time, being endlessly distracted. But, you know, the internet, social networks, it's like any other technology. You know, you watch too much TV, it's a bad thing. You know, you spend all day talking on the phone, you know, it's a bad thing. You know, there's some pretty clear cut lines. And I think, you know, those critiques are valid and can be applied to social networks, but I don't really think there's anything that that new about those critiques.
We're chatting with Fred Stutzman. Fred, let's turn towards your dissertation, where you're focusing on the transition between high school and college and the impact of social media. And you talked a little bit about this at the beginning, but why that focus? I mean, there are a lot of life transitions that exist. Why did you choose to focus on that particular transition?
Well, like many graduate students, I'll cop the answer that it was the data I had, when I started studying social media, college age individuals, people sort of age 16 to 24, were the largest users. And that was the case, you know, from 2002 through 2007, 2008, basically. That's probably the area we know the most about. That's the area that we have sort of a mature audience that we can, or a mature sort of population for study. So there's a lot of, and obviously also the transition to college is a very, very major early life transition. There was sort of that confluence of factors, and of course, obviously being able to get access to the data was key. You know, it's also you have to pick and choose in terms of your topics. And what I want to do with this topic is study more transitions. So I basically want to use this as sort of the pilot in which I can study other transitions. And the wonderful thing about the growth and adoption of social media is that there's a much more diverse population going through a much wider range of transitions on social media. So I want to really take this work and leverage it and apply it to more transitions sort of as I start my career as a researcher.
The focus here is interesting, and I do want to ask you a few more questions about it. One of the things that I know that you've done, and I'll talk about what conclusions you're reaching at this point in a moment, given that you're close to finishing the dissertation. But you mentioned that you were able to collect, I think I understood this correctly, you're able to collect data from Facebook itself, and perhaps you could talk a little bit about that. As you mentioned, and as many listeners know, the privacy issues regarding social media are getting a lot of attention. What data have you been able to gather from Facebook? And if you were able to gather data, how did you get it?
Right. So my dissertation uses a couple of different data sets. And one of those data sets is data I collected from Facebook. Now, Facebook didn't give me the data. So a couple of pieces of context. The data that I used was collected when Facebook was a very early site. Basically, nobody had any idea that they would become the site that they are today. And in those early days, Facebook collaborated with a number of researchers, basically allowing them the ability to crawl their website, basically just collect profile snapshots of people that had public profiles. So I did that. Now, Facebook cut most researchers off in 2006. So I'm using a data set that's for one part of my dissertation that's a number of years old and has been anonymized. And basically, I've tried to do it with I've tried to do this research with the ethics of both the individuals who I'm studying and Facebook, you know, as a company, basically not trying to violate any of their policies. So I have very limited data, and I don't have access to it going forward. I am grateful that I have the data, because what it allows me to do is tell the story through network analysis of the evolution of networks during transition. Basically, I have a snapshot of the networks of the college freshmen at UNC every week for the first semester of their freshman year, and it tells a very interesting story in terms of why people come together, how they, what factors influence their friendships, what factors are very important in terms of the creation of ties, and it tells a tells an interesting sort of subpart, and as you might imagine, just as a sort of data point, the people who you're going to be friends with are the people that you live with. So that's one of the unsurprising and interesting things we find from the study.
So that gets us. We have about 10 minutes left. So what conclusions do you think you're reaching? I mean, and I know that there are many in a dissertation, but do you want to highlight perhaps two or three main ones?
Sure. You know, I use a couple of different data sets in the dissertation. I use obviously the social networks from 2005 that Facebook allowed me to collect. I used a survey that I ran more recently, and qualitative interviews. And so the survey, what I wanted to do was understand really the process of how social networks are beneficial. Basically, there's a good bit of research looking at the relationship between use of a social network site and outcomes, such as an individual's social capital. And so those have been connected. But that's kind of those measures are kind of a beginning in terms of understanding the real processes. So what I wanted to do is actually elaborate the processes. And basically, what I found through statistical evaluation was that individuals who use social support are using them for information seeking and they're using it to find support networks. And it is through that process of finding support networks that social networks' use can be tied to positive outcomes. So, you know, to put it in a nutshell, individuals who use social networks more, who in, they tend to have larger support networks, more supportive networks, and having a more supportive network is, you know, shown to be beneficial in that transition to college. So if you can think about it, you know, going back to my very early story about using social networks, using chat and internet technologies during my transition to college, you know, what I was doing there is I was building out support networks. I was building out connections to people who I could draw on, and I was doing it, you know, online. But even having those online connections is beneficial. And really, in the day and age where our online and offline networks are so intermingled, being an active user of Facebook gives you access to a larger group of people that you can call on when you have a need or when you have a question or you just want to find something to do. So that's kind of interesting. The other sort of set of findings revolves around how students are actually using and sort of spontaneously collaborating to address sort of complex issues during the transition to college. So, you know, one of these is how do you find information about colleges? You can obviously go to the website. You can see what the college says. You can look at their pictures. But for almost all the students that I've talked to, having access to a social network, they use it as a way to connect with the college. And so they do things like virtual college visits, where what they'll do is they'll look through the pictures of people who go to that school and form opinions about the school as a result of that. When they have questions about the school, they turn to the website, of course, but they also turn to people that they know. And so getting information about these very important sort of, you know, everyday questions about college life, a social network site allows people, even people who are not, you know, there in the present, you know, in terms of actually being at college yet, gives them this great sort of network that they can use and draw on in terms of answering their information needs. And really one of the most interesting findings is that students are finding their roommates through Facebook. And you know, schools for a long time, you know, the roommate process, having a good roommate is very important in terms of an individual's adaptation to college. You know, if you get stuck with a great roommate, you're, you know, on all the ways we can measure you, stress levels, support, depression, anxiety, those sorts of things, you're going to perform better than somebody who's got a terrible roommate. So colleges want to get people into roommates with people that are like them, that, you know, and you know, there's kind of a sorting process that goes on there, and there's some sort of issues with that. But just on the very basic sort of supportive outcomes aspect, you know, it's beneficial to have roommates and be connected to people that support you. And so so colleges have worked on this for a long time. They've created roommate, you know, matching services. And they ask kind of very specific and you know, bland questions that colleges are allowed to ask. And they can't ask really in-depth questions about, you know, personal habits and things like that. So what students did is they created a list of about 40 or 50 questions that are incredibly in-depth and very personal. And they answer the questionnaire and they post it to a forum. And people use this questionnaire in this forum to actually find roommates. And so now, you know, at least on my college campus and on other college campuses that I've visited, there's sort of three classifications of roommate. You know, one is, you know, you're the person who found or has your roommate from high school. So, okay, that's as old as, you know, college. Mm-hmm. Second is individuals who go randomly. It's called, you know, individuals who just take the assignment that the college gives. They're the randoms. And then the third are people who found their roommate through Facebook. And interestingly enough, the people who find their roommate through Facebook, I haven't read and run into one of them that's had a bad experience. Mm-hmm. So that's obviously a big kind of future research opportunity for me. So it's very interesting because none of this is, you know, organized by the college. None of it is controlled by the college. It's all spontaneous. It's all self-organized. And that's just having very real impacts on people's lives and their, you know, adaptation to college.
Is there anything that from your dissertation that you think Facebook needs to know in order to improve or change their services?
Huh, that's interesting. Well, you know, the so I am actually thinking about this. And let's see if I can get it into just a couple of neat sentences.
You have about 4 minutes.
Okay, 4 minutes. Okay, all right. Well, one of the things. So when I first started studying Facebook in college, when students would join Facebook, they would have sort of two classes of friends. One is their networks. One is their high school friends, and one is their college students in the new network. So basically, figuring out who they were supposed to be and who they were talking to was pretty easy, because it was either their friends they'd left behind or their new friends. But nowadays, you know, Facebook and all other social networks are widely adopted in the sense that you've got multiple contexts there. So there's kind of two big issues that come out of it. One is that how can students sort of more effectively connect with people in the relevant context? How can they get information from the people that are going through that transition with them at the same time? We need to make news feeds smarter. And so I had a paper this summer that actually looks at sort of ways to look at networks and sort of figure out co-occurrence of transition and use that as a way to prioritize, say, news feed information. So if you want to get information that's primarily from people that you're going through the transition with, you should be able to do it, and a system should be able to figure that out. And the other key issue is privacy. So if you've got multiple contexts, if you've got people from all sorts of groups of life in the same social network, that exerts it makes people a lot more concerned about privacy. And so if you're going to college, you know, thinking about the traditional college experience, it's one where you're, you've moved from high school to college and you're finding new identity. I mean, you know, a big part of the college and growing up experience is figuring out what your identity is going to be. And that's a process of exploration. But if you've got your parents, if you've got your high school friends, if you've got your cousins and basically everybody and their brother in your Facebook network, I think that actually makes it a little bit more difficult to do that very positive exploration that comes along with that transition to adulthood. And so certainly social network sites can be benefited by giving people more simpler privacy controls that allow them to manage those contexts. So those are really kind of two of my big areas that I'm looking at, and really what I'm going to be doing next year is really looking at privacy and social networks as a full-time job. So I hope we can make some good inroads into that problem.
And look, you know, Fred, if as a result of this interview you get a consulting gig with Facebook, I'll just take a 5% finder's fee.
Okay, sounds good.
And that'll work out well. And it's on the radio now, so, you know, I think you've – I'm kidding. So for those people that want to learn more about your work and apps that you're working on, where can they go? Where can they find your material?
Sure, they could Google me, Fred Stutzman. Thankfully, there's not too many of me. My last name is Stutzman. They'll find my webpage. It's fredstutzman.com. And if they want to find out about the apps, Freedom is at macfreedom.com. And you can also find that by just Googling Freedom. It used to be the third internet hit, but now it's the fourth. The Jonathan Franzen book has stolen some of my internet thunder. Hmm. And Antisocial is available at anti-social.cc. Hmm. And you can find that very easily from the Freedom homepage. So macfreedom.com and anti-social.cc.
So just to be clear, the word freedom is now yours on the first page of the Google results. That's impressive. That is it. Is that an optimization effort? Or did that just happen?
It just happened. Yeah, I don't know the first thing about optimization. What I think happened is, you know, people like the New York Times Magazine would link to it and just link to it as freedom. Hmm. And you know, when you've got people, I think it's all about the media. You know, when the media who have the very high ranking link to you as freedom, and you get to be that term.
Yeah.
So yeah, it's very easy to find my website in the sense that you just type in freedom and it's there. So.
Well, congratulations. People pay a lot of money, as you know, to get on that that first page. It sounds like it did it the right way. Well, Fred, it sounds exactly the right way. Fred, thank you for joining us on Hearsay Culture. It's been a great discussion, and good luck finishing your dissertation. I look forward to having you back on the show down the road to talk more about your interesting work.
All right. I appreciate it. Thanks, Dave.
I'm very excited to mention a number of guests that are coming up on Hearsay Culture, people that I think will add to our understanding of these issues. Peter Lee, professor at UC Davis School of Law, will be on next week discussing tech transfer and innovation. Professor Nick Bostrom, the director of the Future of Humanity Institute and professor at the University of Oxford, will be on. Professor Adrian Johns from the University of Chicago, author of the book Piracy. Ryan Kahlo, the director of the Consumer Privacy Project at Stanford's Center for Internet Society. Sarah Rose, the author of For All the Tea in China, will be on as well. Professor Greg Listowka of the Rutgers University School of Law at Camden. We'll be on discussing his new book, Virtual Justice. And rounding out this quarter, Professor Tim Wu of Columbia Law School, author of The Master Switch, The Rise and Fall of Information Empires. As always, you have a number of ways you can listen to the show. The best way to listen is 5 to 6 p.m. Pacific time on KZSU-FM Stanford, but you can also pick up the show by podcast by going either to hearsayculture.com or by picking up the show through Stanford CIS's webpage at cyberlaw.stanford.edu, or by going to our iTunes page. That's Stanford Center for Internet Society's iTunes page, where you can pick up not only Hearsay Culture, but other events at CIS. Thank you much for listening to the show today. I hope you enjoyed it. By the way, you can always email me with comments and questions and suggestions at dave@hearsayculture.com. But enjoy the rest of your day, and I'll look forward to talking to you next week.